This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neil Conan is on vacation. Recently, I took part in an extraordinary event. It was a funeral for an uncle I never knew, Technical Sergeant Matthew Neary, and seven other servicemen whose plane took off from Australia for a flight to Indonesia on September 8, 1945. Not long afterwards, radio contact with the plane broke off. None of the men were ever seen again. Then, 2 years ago, we learned that the plane had been found. It had crashed into a mountain in a remote area of Papua New Guinea.
Dear family and friends, for nearly 150 years, our nation has laid to rest their honored dead here at Arlington National Cemetery. Now we lay to rest our distinguished soldiers and national heroes, Technical Sergeant Matthew F. Neary.
On June 18th, almost 58 years after the crew was declared missing, their remains were buried in Arlington National Cemetery with full military honors. At moments during the ceremony, one lost track of how much time had passed. We were attending a funeral for men who would have been in their 70s and 80s. Death at such an age is natural. Then it would hit you with a start. The funeral was honoring young men, men who'd never had a chance to watch their children grow, to kiss the wife or sweetheart who was waiting for them to write the great novel. Among the many people attending the ceremony was a man a few years older than I, who was a baby when he had last seen his father. Staring at him made me realize just how much had been lost when that plane went down, and how amazing it is that it finally had been found. The discovery of planes like my uncle's and the recovery of the remains of the missing is a story that is becoming increasingly more common. The Pentagon says it is identifying the remains of servicemen and women missing in action in World War II, the Korean War, and Vietnam at an increasing rate, up to 100 a year. Later in the hour, we'll talk about military strategy in Iraq and why Tom Ridge may move up in succession to the presidency. But first, finding and identifying troops who have been missing in action. Have you had a friend or family member's remains recovered? Are you still waiting for such an opportunity? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now in Studio 3A is Larry Greer. He's the Director of Public Affairs for the Defense Department's POW Missing Personnel Office. Thanks so much for being with us, Larry.
It's my pleasure.
First of all, I guess my first question is, why are planes like my uncle's and others being found more frequently now?
Well, one of the reasons is because we've gotten better and better at what we do over the years. We have teams now specifically dedicated to recovering World War II losses, primarily in the South Pacific Islands where your uncle's remains were recovered. But also, we have them programmed against other parts of the world. We've been able to build up our resources thanks to the funding that has been provided us to carry out this mission at a greater pace than we have in the past.
Let's go over how many troops are still missing in action from the different wars, from World War II?
Most people, well, from World War II, the number is staggering. There are 78,000 who are still missing from that conflict. But coming back, the Korean War, there are some 8,100 who are still missing from the Cold War. There are approximately 130 who were lost in shoot-downs flying near the Soviet Union. And then from the Vietnam War, there are 1,884 still unaccounted for or missing.
Now, you mentioned that you have the money to do this now. How did that come about? What's the budget, and where did it come from? When did you get it?
The overall U.S. government budget, the annual budget for doing this recovery work, is about $103 million. It stayed in that range for the past six or eight fiscal years that the government has been doing this in a combined or a united way. What we've done, what the Department of Defense has done, is to combine all the resources, the laboratory specialists, the people who do the investigations, the archivists, and so on, combine them under one policy umbrella. And the office that I represent from Washington here, from the Pentagon, is that office that oversees, at a policy level, oversees all these worldwide operations.
So it's a huge number of people, it sounds like you're talking about. I mean, or a variety, a real variety of people involved in this work.
That's right. On any given day, we say the sun never sets on our mission. There are some 600 people of varying specialties, from forensic anthropologists to archaeologists to medics to explosive ordnance disposal people, to photographers, not out there to take happy snaps, but to document the archaeological type of excavations that we carry on, 600 people at any given time.
Maybe you could take me through the process. I mean, how are these planes found accidentally, or do you go out searching for this kind of thing?
In the case of the Vietnam losses, we've got a pretty good audit trail or track record, if you will, to go back through our case files and to continue the interviewing of witnesses and air crew members who are still alive. And we send teams out physically searching for the sites where we believe them to be. But at the other end of the scale, as far back as World War II, we don't send teams out searching for them. What we do is respond to reports that come to us, usually from local nationals in different countries, like in New Guinea, Papua New Guinea, who report it to the American Embassy, and then it gets back to us, and then we begin an investigation on those cases.
But there can be a big lag time. I mean, as I understand it, in my uncle's case, that the debris was first sighted in 95, and there was this very long time before the family even heard about it.
There can be a lag time. Not always, but frequently there is, especially in the areas of the world where we have to, usually on an annual basis, sit down and negotiate agreements or rights to go in there. And then after you do that, you have to build this huge logistics operation to get these team members, these specialists, to a certain place at a certain time. At the same time, you've got all of these other operations going on around the world, similar negotiations. It's just a big, big operation that does take some time.
We're talking about recovering and identifying the remains of the missing in action from America's wars. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. And let's take a call now from Jim in McCall, Idaho. Hi, Jim.
Hello there.
Hi,
go ahead. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
My father was a P-47 pilot in World War II who was shot down during the Battle of the Bulge, was captured by the Luftwaffe, spent a rest of the war in Luftwaffe hospitals is one of their own. It's quite a story there. But that's not what I want to talk about. What I want to talk about is that two or three years ago, two German National Guardsmen who on weekends go out and find downed planes to properly inter the remains of both Axis and Allied pilots that they find, found my father's plane. And it turned out that he was the first living pilot that they come across. They, through a long set of circumstances, discovered where my dad lived in Idaho and were able to get a hold of him. My parents went over to visit them. They took my father to the crash site after, 1940, after 51 years or something like that. It was an incredibly emotional experience. And we have the whole thing on film because German public television came out to document this event. And so it's been quite a story for us. It's opened up my father to those thoughts and feelings of things that he'd repressed for 55 years. It's been quite a thing for our family.
I bet you've heard some stories that you never heard before now from your father.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's one miracle after another. For instance, he was burned badly all over his face and hands and that kind of stuff, wandered around the snow for 2 days before being captured. His father had given him a pair of white logging boots a couple weeks before. The rest of the guys in his flight had cowboy boots on. Because he had the white loggers on, he bailed out of his plane at over 500 miles an hour, knocked him out on the way down, but his boots didn't come off like the cowboy boots did, so he still has feet. I mean, there's just all those kind of stories that have come out. It's been quite an experience.
Well, thanks so much for your call, Jim.
All right. Thanks a lot. And what I wanted to say is I really appreciate the people all around the world that are doing that kind of volunteer work to find these planes, and it's meant a lot to us.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I was going to say, although Jim came at this from a different angle, his call goes to the heart of this, which is what it means to the families. And I'm just wondering what kind of feedback you get from the families about this.
Of course, I don't want to speak for the families, but I'll tell you what many of them have told us. In some cases, they say, this is the final page of the final chapter that I've never been able to finish this book. I've never been able to finish the story about what happened to my loved one. In many cases, this puts a lot of nightmares, I suppose, to rest on the part of the families. We get constant thank you notes and letters of appreciation. And, of course, when we are able to attend the funerals at Arlington, it helps us, I think, understand what we're really in this for.
Now, Larry, you've gone on some of the excursions into these countries when you're looking for the debris from these planes and the remains. Can you tell us about what that's like? Can you give us a sense of what that experience is like? Maybe take an example of one of the journeys you've made.
The ones that I've been on have been into Vietnam, and it's interesting for me because I served 27 years in the Air Force, and the last time before this that I was in Vietnam was in South Vietnam, and we were trying to bomb the North. But there I was out there in the middle of a rice paddy with some of our team members who were trying to recover the remains of a fellow Air Force officer who had whose aircraft had crashed. By the time we got there, and this is usually a 30-day operation in a general area, the logistics guys on the team had set up a huge area, perhaps half the size of a football field, and they were going through square yard by square yard, excavating the dirt, sifting it through quarter-inch mesh screen, looking for very small fragments of human remains as well as debris, maybe dog tags or ID tags, and putting all of that together, hopefully bringing it back to the laboratory and making a final identification, which can take from months to years after that.
This is the laboratory. There's a laboratory in Hawaii where most of this work is done. Is that what you're referring to?
Right. This is the U.S. Army Central Identification Laboratory in Hawaii, which has been doing this since, frankly, before the Vietnam War.
And how what is involved in the sort of detective work, or what's involved in identifying these remains and finding out who these people are?
Well, as you say, it's like building a detective case. One usually starts with archives, either your archives or the archives of the former enemy, and you try to piece together where you think the individual might have perished. If you have records taken from his particular military flight, you have something to go on. You try to interview witnesses in the local area, villagers. You try to interview the pilots who were also on the flight, the people who were back in the command post who heard radio transmissions, all of which to get that excavation team at precisely the right spot. Hmm. If you're lucky enough, and if you can dodge the monsoon rains in the case of Southeast Asia, and if you find remains, you can bring them back to the laboratory, and all kind of high-tech processes are put into place, including mitochondrial DNA, to try to identify those remains for the family. And at the same time, you have to reach out and find the family, because if you need to do mitochondrial DNA testing on the remains, you have to have an appropriate family member to donate a blood sample to compare their DNA to that of the servicemen.
It really is an extraordinary story of detective work, isn't it?
It really is, yes.
Yeah. And how long after a war can you go into, you know, how long after you hear of these debris being found can you go into the country usually?
Well, in the case of Papua New Guinea, where your uncle's remains were recovered, there are dozens, if not hundreds, of sites waiting to be investigated and identified. It's a long, long process there because there are so many of them. In the case of Vietnam, of course, we still have 1,884 individuals who are missing. And on our work schedule, if you will, we have to attack those every year.
We're talking about finding and identifying the missing in action from World War II, the Korean War, and Vietnam. We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. Send us an email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about the process of recovering members of the military who are still missing in action. Our guest is Larry Greer. He is the Director of Public Affairs for the Defense Department's POW Missing Personnel Office. He joins us here in Studio A. What are your questions about the science and policy behind the government's policy to recover MIAs? Do you have a family member who's missing in action? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from his office in Kansas City is David Olson. He is the son of Delbert Austin Olson, a naval commander in Vietnam. His plane went down in 1968. Commander Olson was laid to rest at Arlington Cemetery last month. Thanks for being with us, David. How old were you, first of all, when your father's plane went down?
I was 7.5 years old.
And what do you remember being told about it?
I remember the military vehicles coming to the home and playing outside as the men stood by the vehicles as the officers went in to speak with my mom and just not knowing what was going on, just knowing that my dad was not with them, and that was unusual for me.
Knowing that he was missing, that was all you knew, how did that affect your life, the fact that you never had any conclusive answer?
There was always hope that they'd find him, that all of a sudden he'd show up. You know, you never, I guess, lose the faith and the hope that he would come back to you and be part of your life again.
When did your family learn that the wreckage had been found?
We heard, you know, several things, I guess a month or so after that, the first report that he was missing in action, and then it was believed missing in action changed to KIA, or killed in action, body not recoverable. And we heard from the Pentagon that there was some aerial photographs of the crash site and bodies laying amongst the wreckage and the tail section still intact, believe no survivors, and they read off the tail number, and that was pretty much a done thing there.
And what year was that? When was that then?
It was, probably the end of 1968. Within months afterwards, we were told that they found the wreckage believed to be, of that plane.
And then did the Navy stay in touch with you, or?
It seemed like it was years. Every year we'd get a Christmas card from the White House, and then 3 days before Christmas, one year when I was in college, I got a telegram stating that they found a starboard identification placard off the aircraft, and it was in a village, and somebody turned it in, and then they found some pieces of the aircraft being used as parts of a hut in a village nearby, and so no, really no definite conclusions.
When did you find out that the remains were being recovered, or that process had started?
It was about 1996. And they were trying to get into the crash site. The Silhai and the teams were doing everything they could to recover these men, because there was eight men in that wreck. And they kept trying to go in, and the monsoon season would start, and then there was poisonous snakes, and it was on the side of a mountain, and it was hard to get to, and of course the Laotian government was not all the time cooperative back then. And they finally would go in and get something and say, well, we can't go back. It's too dangerous for these men. And it's like the men they lost in that helicopter crash a couple years ago. You begin to question if it's something that should be done and risk other people's lives to bring home, the lives that have been lost so long ago.
Once the final identification was made and you were notified of that, what was the effect of that news?
I kind of hate the term because I've heard it so much lately, but closure is a good term. It's kind of the long end of a final journey, and I was hopeful that we could get this done and get these men back home to U.S. soil before a lot of the elderly relatives of some of these men are gone. And every year that goes by, it seems like it's possible to lose more people, that it would be something in their life that they are really needing to accomplish.
Were a lot of your family members ultimately able to attend the funeral service?
Yes, my whole family went, and it was really nice to have everybody there supporting and being a part of this. I went to Hawaii to escort him home with my sister Dana, and it was very humbling and an honor to bring these men home.
Maybe you can tell us a bit about the service and your own feelings at that time.
it's something where it was a bit surreal because it's you have been waiting for this moment for so long, and then when it came and the cloud cover was too low, and I was, you know, they were going to do a flyover, so they couldn't get the aircraft up to do the flyover. But the way that these the services were carried out with the honors that they bestowed upon these men was just something to experience. It was really incredible that how the men proceed in with the casket and how they handle everything and you know the horse-drawn caisson as they're going to the gravesite and the 21-gun salute and just everything that happened at the service was really incredible.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, David.
Sure, thank you very much.
David Olson is the son of a recently identified commander in the Navy. His father's remains were identified and buried recently at Arlington National Cemetery. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. And let's go to Jay in Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Jay.
Yes, hello. My question is that although I would say the cause of finding these POW or people that have gone down in accidents is a noble one, but since we're dealing with limited resources in these times, wouldn't a budget like that over like a 10-year period be more efficiently used for something like Homeland Security and trying to save lives in the future?
Well, thanks for that question, Jay. I'm going to let Larry Greer take that.
I'll take that off the air.
Okay, thanks so much for calling.
Okay.
Larry, maybe you can respond to that. I'm sure a number of people have questions about is this money being well spent?
Sure. It's a determination that the citizens of this country have made through their elected representatives and to those in the administration. It's not for me to say what's enough and what's too much. The point is, I think, that the families of those servicemen who have made their sacrifice, have given their lives for their country, they deserve this. They deserve not to be forgotten, and that's what we're about when we carry out this mission.
And the funerals, do all of these servicemen who have been missing and whose remains are found, do they all get these military funerals with full honors?
It's up to the families. Once the servicemen's remains are identified, the family has the opportunity to have them buried at Arlington National Cemetery or in their hometown cemetery if they so choose. But all of that, of course, is provided by the U.S. government. The family suffers no expense for those types of services.
Larry Greer is the Director of Public Affairs for the Defense Department's POW Missing Personnel Office. And joining us now from Rockville, Maryland, is Suzanne Barrett. She is the technical leader of the Mitochondrial DNA Section, the Armed Forces DNA Identification Laboratory, and she's one of the scientists who helps with the identification process. Thanks for joining us, Suzanne.
Oh, sure, no problem.
Maybe you can explain to us what your role is in this process of identifying the remains of these people who have been missing in action for a long time.
Well, Larry mentioned that it's similar to putting together a puzzle, and our laboratory and the DNA process is just a piece of that puzzle. What we're looking for is we are doing mitochondrial DNA testing of these remains, and the process does start at Silhi, and they have a bunch of odontologists, anthropologists, and researchers who start the case in the identification process over there. And then they send us a portion of the remains, usually a bone or a tooth sample, to start the DNA process.
Now, in order to do that, you have to contact a relative. Larry mentioned that earlier. I mean, how does that explain the whole process?
Well, the casualty officers are involved with that. Silhi alerts the casualty officers who they think these remains are. And when we obtain a bone sample, it's pretty much in the blind. So we are testing it in the blind. We have no idea at that point who these remains belong to. And it's only until after we've identified a sequence for those remains that Silhi will then tell us who the reference is.
That you'll then try and match it up with one of the blood samples that has been collected? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. Are you always able to identify the remains completely, accurately?
Well, certainly it depends on the conditions of the remains. Sometimes we are not able to get a result but as of right now, we're about 80% successful.
What are the biggest challenges involved in this identification process from a DNA perspective?
Well, these are probably one of the most challenged samples in the world, which is why one of the reasons why we have to use mitochondrial DNA. And so we are dealing with a very low level of DNA. So we have all sorts of concerns, from DNA degradation to modern contamination, all down the line. You know, who handled it? Are we getting it all off? Are we getting the authentic DNA and just really getting an accurate result?
Larry, if I could turn to you for a second, is this the only way that the remains are identified, through mitochondrial DNA?
No, not at all. In fact, the Silhi Laboratory, Central Identification Laboratory in Hawaii, uses mitochondrial DNA in about 40% to 50% of the cases, which means that the other half of the cases are being identified using traditional forensic methods, including dental charts, dental X-rays, and that sort of thing.
And also just dog tags, is that part of the process, finding things like the dog tag?
That can be helpful, but you can't identify remains just based on the proximity of a dog tag, because in the case of course, these high-speed jet crashes, you had 2 to 10 people on board an airplane. Finding the dog tag can be useful, and it can point the forensic anthropologist in the right direction, but you need a lot more biological evidence beyond that.
Yeah. And Suzanne, just one last question. How close a relative do you need to get a sample from in order to make this identification?
Well, that's the good thing about mitochondrial DNA, is that it's maternally inherited, meaning that everybody in your maternal line will have the same mitochondrial DNA sequence. So we're able to use distant relatives as references.
Okay, thanks very much, Suzanne.
You're welcome.
Suzanne Barrett is the technical leader of the mitochondrial DNA section, Armed Forces DNA Laboratory, and she joined us from her office in Rockville, Maryland. Larry, maybe we can start talking about how this all comes together when you do contact the families and track them down. That must be a pretty long and complex piece of detective work as well, I would think, sometimes.
It can be, and the military services, the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, use all of the high-tech tools of today's Internet, if you will, to try to find the relatives of these servicemen. When they are absolutely unable to do that, some of them have even contracted out to genealogists who will spend months and months tracking down long-lost family members just to let them know what we're doing and why we need to talk to them, obviously to make final disposition of the remains, but in some cases to draw a blood sample from them if they're willing to offer a comparison sample. That the search for families can be the missing puzzle in the whole operation, and if you can't get that family member, it brings a lot of things to a complete halt.
And that happens sometimes.
It does, but we never give up because the technology that might be available that may not be available to us today, who knows, a couple of years from now we may have something that'll be helpful.
Larry Greer is the Director of Public Affairs for the Defense Department's POW Missing Personnel Office. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Gretchen in Mountain View, California. Hi, Gretchen.
Hello. I'm glad to hear that this work on identifying the remains of missing soldiers has been going on. My uncle was shot down over the English Channel in World War II. He was an American flying with the RAF. At the time, the British Red Cross tried very, very hard to find out exactly what happened to them, but they were completely unsuccessful. We have, to this day, we have never heard anything more about him, and I'm wondering if there are many cases like this where the truth will simply never be known, and as painful as it may be not to have what's so often called closure, that perhaps as our family has simply had to accept that we will never know.
Larry Greer?
Sadly, I think Gretchen's story is unfortunately lived by many family members who have always wondered from as far back as the 40s what might have happened to their fallen loved one. With 78,000 from World War II who are still missing, I'm afraid that, to be realistic about it, we've only got an opportunity to find a fraction of them and to bring closure to their families. We have all manner of high-tech equipment and search methods to do it, but it's a big, big job that may take us longer than the rest of us have.
Thanks for your call, Gretchen. Joanne in New Hartford, New York. Hi, Joanne.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. My father was shot down in 1966 somewhere near Hanoi. And we know he was alive when he hit the ground. And that's the last we heard of him until 1977. He was listed as missing in action for 11 years. And in August of 77, my mother was notified that they had found his remains. And we got quite a detailed report back from the lab in Hawaii as to the state of the remains, but they had positively identified him. And my mother had held out hope for such a long time. In fact, only a month before they had found his remains, my mother had petitioned the government to have my father declared dead so that she could go on with her life. She raised four daughters on her own, which was not exactly something she was prepared for, but luckily she had four pretty good kids. My father was part of that. But it was really important that we have his body back. It really was.
Well, again, Joanne, I think this speaks to this topic of this whole show, and that is what it means to the people, no matter how long the time has been since they heard anything about their relatives, what it finally means to have that kind of information. It's kind of hard to explain to people who haven't had the experience, I guess.
Well, it was interesting because a lot of people, while I was growing up, I was almost 10 years old when Dad was shot down, and I was 21 when his body came home, and we buried him at Arlington. And a lot of people, because of the nature of the Vietnam War, and it was such a politically and publicly, there was a problem. A lot of people had a problem with that. And a lot of people would hear about the situation and look at you and say, he got what he deserved. And it was like, excuse me, he was doing his job. And well, that was kind of rough to grow up with. But the government was really good to us. They were extremely good to my mother. And I think that helped a lot. Also, I would say to the caller who said perhaps the money should be spent elsewhere, I don't know if it were a member of his family.
All right.
He would feel differently.
Thanks so much for calling, Joanne. Thanks for telling us and sharing your story. And thanks also to Larry Greer of the Defense Department. When we come back, we'll be talking about the military strategy in Iraq and why Paul Ridge may be the eighth in line to succeed the president. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.